Okay, well, here we are again, the U.S. war against Iran, and I'm afraid we kind of have gone back to crazy town. Some things that just don't seem to be making any sense. President Trump has been really all over the map. He's been talking about 48 hours. We're going to have an ultimatum and we're going to destroy your energy if you don't. And then it's like, okay, you know what? Here's 5 days. And then it's like, hey, you know what? We're talking to people. They gave me a gift. And now it's back to, well, they're totally defeated and they're begging me for a deal. This is what he said just moments ago from the White House.
We're extremely, really a lot ahead of schedule. The Iranian regime is now admitting to itself that they have been decisively defeated. They're saying to people, this is a disaster. They know it. That's why they're talking to us. They wouldn't talk otherwise. But they're talking to us because they've got a disaster on their hands. They're defeated. They can't make a comeback. We're free to roam over there. Cities and towns and destroy all of their crazy nuclear weapons and missiles and drones that they're building. And we're doing that. They now have a chance to make a deal, but that's up to them. And they'll tell you, we're not negotiating. We will not negotiate. Of course they're negotiating. They've been obliterated. Who wouldn't negotiate? They are begging to make a deal. We'll see if we can make the right deal. And if they make the right deal, then the strait will open up.
Well, and then just magically the strait will open up and everything will be fine. The clouds will shine. The birds will sing. We'll see if that works out that way or not. And to try and help us make sense of the something that probably can't make sense is Commodore Steve Jeremy, retired from the Royal Navy, combat veteran himself and friend of the show. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, it's good to be back, Danny. To rest assured that you've probably got a twin of crazy town because we've got one over here. It's up in London, I'm afraid.
Well, maybe it's a contest to see who could be the most crazy. Yeah. But I think right now we're winning. I'm just got to say. Let's just start right off the top there. When he says that, we'll start, this is a number of things he said in there, but we'll start with one of the first ones, that they are totally defeated. How do you see it militarily?
I can't see any evidence for that whatsoever. I mean, you could say that lots of bombs have been dropped, but there again, lots of bombs were dropped during Operation Rolling Thunder in Vietnam, and that didn't work. And the issue, though, is, yeah, what are the objectives? I mean, the defeat surely only comes when you've achieved your objectives. And as far as we can see, the primary objective has been set out as government overthrow, what the Pentagon and the White House are calling regime change, but it is government overthrow. And there's no evidence for that whatsoever. So to suggest that they've been defeated is simply suggest that we've dropped lots of bombs, which is true, but there's no evidence of defeat. And again, it shows a misunderstanding of how Iranians think and how their theocracy, and that's not meant to be a pejorative term, but how they think theologically and how their Shia doctrine, which goes back to the Battle of Karbala in 680 AD, and which is used to standing up against what they see as oppression in the name of justice, it means that they are likely to keep going. And I would be astonished if they do come to the table, and I would not be at all surprised if, in fact, we're just looking at longer delays. So, short answer is I don't think they have been defeated, Danny. I can see no evidence of it.
Well, now what is this going to do to any potential negotiations? Because in the last few days, you've had a number of Iranian officials say, there's not going to be any discussions. And by the way, we're going to show you what the Iranian foreign minister is saying earlier today in just a second. But what would they be negotiating with? Because this Trump is all over the map. I mean, he from the Oval Office day before yesterday was bragging about this gift that Iran had given him. And he said, that shows we're talking to the right person and we're talking to somebody at the highest levels. And I'm not going to tell you who it is because I don't want him to be killed either by apparently Israel or by Iranians who may not want anybody to be talking with this, implying that there's discord at the higher levels inside of the Iranian government. But I mean, there is the Iranian government and they still have their president, Pezeshkian. They still have the foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, and he's been the face all the way through this for before, during, and current. But what is he going to negotiate with? Because he said on one hand that we're willing to talk to the United States through intermediaries, but only for stuff that's on our terms. But now here's Trump saying, well, no, they are begging for us to do. Of course they're negotiating because they're being defeated. So if that is just a myth and just fiction, what can you say about what the Iranian side, what can they do with that?
I mean, their terms are clear, aren't they, Danny? So the terms are end of sanctions, full reparations to be paid, a toll booth on the Strait of Hormuz, the continuation of their nuclear program and their missiles program, and the exit of all American bases from the Gulf Arab states. And those seem clear to me. I haven't seen any sense that they're going to change those. And I think what we're in the situation, it's not unlike in some ways the situation in the earlier stages of the Ukraine-Russia war, where at the moment we've got what appears to be the side who are on the back foot, which is Israel and America, trying to dictate the terms to the side which is on the front foot because of the way in which it's fighting the war. And, you know, the three things that you and I forecast many, many months ago, I think, that would probably happen if this war kicked off, which is that Israel would be subject to an intense strategic bombardment, which it is. I think we know as best we can. And if it isn't, you wonder why there is a media blackout in Israel. The second is the attacks on American bases, which appear to have been so successful that Americans aren't actually at the bases. They're actually outside the bases, so to keep clear of them. And the third are the Straits of Hormuz. And of those, the trump card, you know, the queen on the diplomatic battlefield is the Straits of Hormuz, because it's doing untold damage to the world economy. So for those reasons, you know, we've got two very different positions.
And let me just talk, as you're talking here, just to validate both the points you just made there. This is the sustained rate of fire from the Iranian side against Israel specifically. And you can see that they had a big splurge the first two or three days. But since that time, it's been on a pretty steady sustained rate, reaching a nadir on, I guess it was about the 9th, where only 10 missiles. But then you see pretty much from that time, it's been between 20 and 10 every day, never lower than 10, never higher than 20. But it's a very sustained rate. And from all that we can assess, they have the ability to sustain that rate. And as we certainly know, then to your point here, a lot of the missiles are running out, the air defense missiles. And in fact, the United States, this is the New York Times here, talking about how we have been forced out of many of our places. It says the American troops have had to relocate to hotels, office bases throughout the region. Many of the 13 military bases in the region used by American troops are all but uninhabitable. That doesn't sound like somebody who's been defeated to me. How about you?
Yeah, no, definitely not being defeated, is it? Unless you can somehow demonstrate that retreat from those bases is victory. It didn't sound like victory to me. But it's a pragmatic response to the knowledge that actually if people stay at the bases, they're going to be attacked, and those attacks will lead to even more casualties than so far the US have had. I mean, it's a very wise thing to do tactically to remove people from those bases. It also, I think, shows just the vulnerability of bases generally. I think it's a point I've made before, which is that people often talk about the vulnerability of aircraft carriers, and of course they've got a point. But aircraft carriers are less vulnerable, I would say, than static land bases, because at least an aircraft carrier can move, which of course a land base can't. So I think there's no sign there to me of that. I think the issues really, though, although I think this is a tactical issue, Danny, and I think the more strategic issues are the bombardment of Israel, because that must be affecting the political calculus in Israel, at least starting to affect it. But also,
let me interrupt here a little bit while I came off that headline up there. So we just heard what President Trump said. That was cut from the cabinet meeting he was making. But then you see that subhead right there, that President Trump has questioned the prospect of an agreement with Iran to end the war and said it might be too late. Well, wait a minute. You just said really emphatically that, of course, they're begging you for a deal. So how is it going to be too late? I mean, this kind of mixed messaging has got to confuse everybody, whether you're opponents or your allies.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it even confuses the market, doesn't it, Danny? Although I wonder if that's the one area where actually the president is very good in terms of how he messages. He always has managed to message just after a bet has been placed on the markets. And we're not quite sure what's going on there, but we can guess. But no, I think this mixed message is extremely difficult. It's been the same in the Russia-Ukraine war, because what one is used to in wars is as professional diplomats and professional strategic analysts and professionals working on both sides. And so you then get a consistency of message. We've seen that from the Russians. The Russians have been completely consistent during the Russia-Ukraine war. And from what I can see, the Iranians have been completely consistent as well. But of course, this mixed messaging is due, I think, to confusion in the White House about what the strategy is, what the objectives are, and what the overall state of the campaign is. My guess, though, is that within the White House, there is a lot of concern, if not at the not in the president's mind, elsewhere in the White House. I'd be astonished if there isn't concern. It'll be really interesting to see how that plays out.
Let me just put on the screen here. You talked about the markets. I mean, you can see all these gyrations. This is when Trump, first of all, said we got rid of the 48-hour deadline. That made a big drop, but then it kind of started tilting back up. And then he said, I think before the Tuesday night, maybe Wednesday night, I said, well, here we got a 15-point plan on the deal because we want to have a negotiated settlement. And then it dropped again. But now then, since that time, it's been going back up. And then this was, let's see, what time was that one? That was at 10:45 this morning, so it was a little bit of dip, but there doesn't seem to be another dip. It's like people are not paying attention to what he says now, and the market's going almost back up to where it was before he made that first statement. So what does that tell you?
Yeah, I think what it tells me is the market's confused. I think that they're trying to work out what actually is going on. That my recommendation would be to actually listen to people like us, because we seem to be to have we seem to have something which the most of the Western commentariat and most of the Western security thinkers haven't got, which is prescience, which we seem to be not perfect in forecasting, but a lot better than everybody else. And I think it's largely speaking because we're doing it on the basis of rational analysis, looking at the evidence rather than what we might think is best. I think what's very interesting, and we haven't talked yet about the Strait of Hormuz, but I was listening to Luke Groman, who you may or may not have come across. I think he's an exceptional American analyst. And I'm very happy to share with you a podcast or a YouTube video he did yesterday. And he exactly mirrored something that I'd said to you in the last time we did this. He said in terms of what this all looks like, as far as the market's concerned, he says it's binary. He said it all depends on the Strait of Hormuz. He said if it's not cleared in 2 to 4 weeks, we're then going to be in a situation, an economic catastrophe, which is unlike anything. And I think I won't quite get his phraseology right, but it's unlike anything that we have ever seen in any of our lifetimes. I completely agree with him. It's pretty much exactly the same thing that I think I said to you when we last talked, Annie. But it was very helpful for me. Pessimistic, I suppose you could say. I think I would call it realistic. It was very helpful for me to hear somebody else say that, because it makes me think that if you've got somebody of the quality of Luke Groman saying that, then we're on the same page and we're heading in the right direction. We can talk in a bit.
I guess challenging for us, and sometimes we need that kind of reinforcement, because the consequences ramifications of what we're saying in our analysis, you think that can't be. My formula must be wrong somewhere. I must have did something wrong with the calculations, because that's not conceivable with the modern world that I know and the intelligence and everything else of the West that I have grown up with. So I must have been wrong. But you do the calculations over and over in the analysis, and it still comes up to this crazy stuff. And you're like, wait a minute, it's accurate. It really is that bad. And we are making that many unforced errors, I think, as I can call them. So it's good to have that reinforcement. But unfortunately, that reinforcement is balanced off on the other side by making it challenging. Here is Jack Keane talking about the Strait of Hormuz. Listen to his characterization of this. Remember, this is a retired 4-star general.
These people that say, oh my, the Iranians kind of surprised us with the Straits of Hormuz. Give me a break. This has been a part of our repertoire for years. Listen, Admiral Cooper, who you had there discussing what's come going down. The reality is, on the Straits of Hormuz, we are going to take that by force and keep it open for as long as we have to be there to keep it open. And that is why we appealed for assistance, because we have warships who are doing offensive operations. We have warships who are doing defensive operations. And obviously, we can spare some to do some escorting through the Straits. But we needed help for others to come. And obviously, now they are coming. And they're coming by the scores. Now we're up to 30 countries that want to help.
Okay, so let's take a look at that. So, but now he says, give me a break. Of course we foresaw this. Well, then one would reasonably ask, why did you allow the Strait to be closed in the first place if you foresaw it? But we'll table that for the moment. But then the last part there, he says, we definitely got this. And now people are coming to us by the scores. And they're definitely going to help us. Now we're up to 30. I have yet to see a single warship to come down in to help us out. Have you seen anybody?
No. And I think that it's, in a way, it's quite helpful that General Keane hasn't been sent off to our platoon in the Ukraine war, because actually he gives us something to talk about from the other perspective. I mean, the truth is that there has been no commitment, as far as I'm aware, of any force other than Israeli forces to the war, and for the very very good reason that they don't want to be part of the war. They weren't involved in the decision making in the war. And they will know, I'm sure, in the way that I would. I mean, if I were advising, I would say this is not something we want to be part of. And the reason is that if you throw warships into the Strait, with or without amphibious support on the north side of the Straits, it's going to be a bloodbath. It'll be a bloodbath for the warships. And I cannot imagine a worse place to actually go in. I mean, my experience is both... in the Falklands War, where we did do an amphibious operation, but it was done at night, Danny, with at least six different landing locations at which we could have landed. And we managed to achieve a complete surprise. But then even then, when we had soldiers and Marines ashore, it was still hard work despite that surprise, because we got about 24 hours before we were properly located.
On that operation you're talking about, how many total troops in these six locations did you have?
We landed on one location. That was the key, Danny, although there were two subsets of the location. But the key issue was that we achieved surprise, and it was a very difficult place to attack because of the nature of the terrain. It was very cleverly chosen by a guy I know well, Mike Crabb. I've forgotten his second name now, but he was the at sea commander, and he had a brilliant general, Brigadier Julian Thompson, who is one of Marine, but a very, very clever thinker. And the two of them worked hand in glove with each other. But even then, I think I mentioned to you before, when we did that operation with relatively limited air offensive forces against us, it was relatively limited compared to what the Iranians can do in the Strait. We still lost, over the period of that war, six frigates and destroyers sunk, six frigates and destroyers sunk, and two amphibious ships badly damaged with lots of casualties, and an offshore we had a very significant loss of a logistic ship. So yeah, that wasn't easy, and that was with Argentinian Air Force and their air arm operating at significant range, 400 miles from where we are. And they were incredibly brave, there's no doubt about it. But we achieved that in that way. But here you're right next door to the location, the one location where everybody can see. And when we were doing this, there was no prospect of ballistic missiles, or no prospect of moraine, of hypersonic missiles, and no prospect of drones, whereas all of those would need to be taken into account, as indeed would fast boats, as indeed would mines. So, you know, you're throwing yourself into a really, really difficult location with very little sea room, which is space to maneuver. It's got all the prospects of something which is much worse than some of the things that have been done before. I've talked about Gallipoli, another very...
And by the way, I'm sorry, you're talking about Operation Sutton. Is that what we were talking about?
Yeah. This was the key moment of the war, in a way, because we need to get those troops ashore. Because the difference then, Danny, is that once they were ashore, they were much they were in a much more secure position because there wasn't artillery. We were far enough away from Port Stanley, which was the location where eventually it was on which the whole war hinged. But there was no prospect of strategic bombardment of the land locations using drones and missiles and hypersonic missiles, whereas here it's the opposite. So even once you've got the land forces safely ashore, those land forces will be subject, I'm sure, to strategic bombardment. And it will be bombarded with drones.
Steve, can I interrupt for a second? We're having some trouble with your audio. Could you actually exit and then come back in for us?
Yeah, I'll exit and come back in.
That'd be great. Thank you. Danny.
Yeah, sorry about that. While we're getting that worked up here, I want to go with something else President Trump said earlier today, which was very odd, I guess we could say. Gary, if you could play the one about his comments on NATO.
I had to do a little stopover. I call it an excursion. I had to do a little stopover in Iran, and we had to knock the hell out of them because our country would not have been safe. The world wouldn't have been safe. I've done a great favor for the world. The world has not been, it has not been reciprocal, because when I told NATO, where we give billions and billions of dollars, trillions over the years, I said, do you mind coming up and giving us a little hand with the streets? Send up some. They didn't want to get involved. And I believe that's going to cost them dearly.
Yeah, yes, he's done a great favor to the world. It's really hard to know what he's talking about there, because so far he has plunged the world into a real problem economically across the globe with the rising of the price of oil. You see, it's now trickling back up to $100, despite the drop he had earlier in the week down to the 80s. Now it's getting closer back to 100. And depending on what does or doesn't happen this weekend, that could now pierce that $100 ceiling and continue flying north. And that's going to be a bigger problem. Meanwhile, he has handed control to the Iranians of the strait. So they have a chokehold on a fifth of all production in the world right now, and we don't have any way to stop it. And when he's talking about NATO listening, I'm just looking for a little help. Like, Jeremy, we just saw this soundbite where President Trump is mocking NATO and saying, listen, I've done a great favor for the world by taking out this great Satan of Iran and their nuclear weapons and all this stuff, even though our own intelligence said there was no nuclear weapon program and nothing that they had. But anyway, we'll talk about that another day. But now he's starting to say, I want NATO to come in and send some ships to just clear this up. Now, we're starting to talk about the physical issue of using naval power to open this up. And so let me ask that question right here. First of all, despite whether these countries in NATO are or are not going to send ships, can you explain to us if naval power alone can open the straits, meaning if UK, if France said, you know what, we'll send you whatever, half a dozen frigates, and we'll start escorting ships through. Is that enough to open the strait?
No, definitely not. If I were asked to do the operation, the thing that I would want to do is control the north shore of the straits, Danny. I mean, the last thing you want to do, which is exactly what happened in Gallipoli, was to try to get through the Dardanelles. And in the Dardanelles, we did not have control of either side. So we were trying to use, this isn't the First World War, I should say, trying to use naval forces, British and French forces, to force the Dardanelles. The ships were struck by mines. Two battleships sank. Another two were badly damaged. And then when we withdrew, realizing that we couldn't do it straight away, we then came back with land forces and had a terrible fight on the Dardanelles Peninsula, the Gallipoli Peninsula. And in the Gallipoli Peninsula, I mean, you can see the size of those forces. So you've got a division there, the 29th Division, and the ANZAC, which is New Zealand and South and Australia, you know, at that level of deployment. And you know, we're talking for the viewers, the three stars is a core level deployment, which is, you know, two or three divisions, and the two star is a divisional level deployment. At the moment, you all know as well as I think, Andy, that we're talking about the 82nd Airborne and two Marine Expeditionary Units. So there's nowhere near the level of combat power that you would need to actually land and secure the north side of the straits. And to do it without that security, it's like sending the ships through as if they're walking through a shooting range.
So what you know, let's talk about this because I mean, yeah. I guess you're talking about this area here north of the horseshoe. Let's just say that they were going to hit Kashim Island, which is this elongated one right here, and say, yeah, if we own that, then we'll be control of this going through the straits here. But we have, and by the way, for those who may not know, don't look at this number of 5,000 Marines that we're talking about on these two Marine Expeditionary Units. Each of these MEUs, the 31st and the 11th, have one combat battalion. One combat battalion each of combat of actual foot soldier combat power. The 82nd has one brigade, about 3,000 total troops, and those are not all trigger pullers. But can you compare just the size of the land force? We're talking basically the equivalent of maybe five battalions of total infantry combat power, all on foot.
Yeah, exactly that. So I mean, I think the point if we just think back to the Gallipoli. Map that Gary showed very usefully. There's a core there, so we're talking about three divisions there, each no doubt of, unless it's a square division, but let's assume they're triangular division, they're each three divisions of three brigades. So, you know, I won't try and do the maths in my head, I'm not clever enough, but there's lots of combat power there. I think the figure that we were talking to Doug McGregor about this yesterday, and I think the figure he said was about 500,000 troops, Western troops, were involved in Gallipoli. Yeah, and so to have any sense, any chance of doing this, that's the sort of level of combat power I would expect to want to have deployed there, Danny. I mean, you tell me if you think I'm wrong, but to secure that northern territory, that's the sort of level that I want. And without securing it, then essentially you've got... you're within sort of 5 to 10 miles of an enemy shore, which is not good. Ships do not do well when they're actually close in like that. And there are a number of reasons, but one of them is that you've got so little time to react. So if a drone comes across that you can't see, suddenly it's within you. It's with you very, very quickly. There may be miniature submarines there. There may be mines there. And certainly if there's any prospect of ships trying to penetrate that strait, warships, then the first thing I'd do as Iranian commander is I would mine it. And again, I would know that if I mine it, that not only would I might try to not mine the north part so that I could at least allow friendly nations to get through it, but I certainly would mine the south part. And mining is really, really difficult. It's extended operations and takes a lot of time. I mean, to show you the way that we actually thought about this in the Falklands War was that we were worried about the strait between the two Falklands Islands. And the way that we worked out if that was mined or not was sent a Type 21 frigate through it. Chris Craig went through, I think, in his frigate. And he knew at the time that he was going through and we didn't know whether there were mines or not. He wasn't blown up, so we worked out that we got through. But if a mine hits a ship, it's mission critical damage. The mine goes off usually a bit deep, and because it's a big warhead, 400, 500 kilograms, it breaks the back of the ship very often. So, you know, the ships, if it doesn't sink, and very often they do, but if it doesn't sink, then it is a mission kill, which means that ship's then not available, even if it secures. And then, of course, you've got to get the ship out. So, you know, mining as of its own is a big threat, as indeed are all the other threats.
Okay, so let me ask you something. We've talked a little bit about the Falklands and looking at the geography here, but can you tell us, walk us through a little bit the one you took part in, which was Operation Sutton? I have this map up here. Yes. Can you tell us the size of the formation here and then what happened with it when you tried?
Yeah, so what you can see is that the ships came in from the north and they penetrated through into what's known as San Carlos Water. I wasn't there initially, but we deployed there towards the end of the war after the bases had been secured. But what was landed, I won't get this exactly right, Danny, but I won't be far off. But what they landed was a reinforced brigade. So it was three commander brigade, which had three commandos, which is the same as a battalion, Danny, and then two parachute battalions as well. So parachute regiment, which are our sort of 82nd airborne, they're airborne troops. And those were, at the time, I think it would be fair to say, the best in the British Armed Forces. And they're very, very good light infantry troops. But of course, they had to be supported by logistics. So there were big logistics ships were actually in those locations. And we were getting as much stuff ashore as possible. But after a bit, I think after about day or three, four, because of the intensity of the air attacks, the logistics ships actually withdrew because we were too worried about losing logistics ships. So it was successful, and there wasn't a counterattack. But the threats compared to what we would be currently facing in the Straits of Hormuz, it's an order of magnitude worse. And even with this one, we had a lot of casualties. So the warships actually stationed themselves outside the San Carlos, and it was the warships which took the brunt of it, Danny. So within that zone, we lost three or four warships. I'll have to think back to it. I think it was three warships around the zone, and then further out, another three warships over the period of the combat, and they were sunk.
So what if instead of having warship support, what if the U.S. just tried V-22 Osprey tilt rotors or Chinooks or Black Hawk helicopters? So they just made an air insertion. Would that make it better or worse?
I wouldn't think it'd make it better or worse. It would just be different. Firstly, I have heard, I think we talked just before we started, about the possibility of UAE providing basis for an air assault. So you're talking about an air assault there as opposed to an amphibious assault. And again, there are different issues. The thing with an air assault is that it's, again, the issue you have with an air assault is again the same one of surprise. So you need to actually suppress.
So there could be some UAE. This is UAE right here. So
further down. So it's those sorts of areas. And again, you could be from further afield as well. The Osprey will go a long way, and the aircraft will go a long way. But yeah, helicopters.
About 32 miles across from the close nearest.
Yeah, that's around. You know, Osprey at speed, I think it's about 350 knots. It might be 320 knots. So these are high-speed aircraft until they transition into hover. But the issue is getting the amount of troops you need ashore to actually secure your landing zone. I often think back to one of my favorite movies of all time, which is We Were Soldiers Once. I don't know how well you know it.
Oh, yeah, the Vietnam War.
It would be a bit like that, Danny, in a sort of different force, but like landing the same force that was landed, air mobile force that was landed in Da Nang. It would have the same level, I think, of incoming responsive fire, if not more. Because, of course, in Da Nang, the North Vietnamese division, which the US had not realized was there, responded quite quickly. But it did not expect it. So at least in Da Nang, the American battalion, I think it was battalion, if I'm sure it was a battalion, Danny, I can't remember which one it was, 7th Cavalry from memory.
But I'm looking at here, the landing at Da Nang was the 9th Marine Expeditionary Brigade.
Yeah. Do I mean Da Nang, Danny? I'm not sure I do. It's the one where it was the first air assault into the territory of deep into North Vietnamese territory.
That is correct. Yeah.
Yeah. And in it, I think it was a battalion. But again, the issue, of course, you've got again with air, and I speak as a naval aviator, is logistics. And the problem with logistics is that aviation is a slow way to move logistics. In the Falklands War, a really good example, it's almost all of the troops, all the use of the helicopters, because we lost them early on, was in moving of ammunition. And ammunition is really the levels of ammunition that were used were levels that we just hadn't anticipated. But also anything else that moves by air, you know, it's hard work. Chinooks move things well by air. But in most operations, then 90% of the logistics comes by sea. So, you know, it's a very tough thing to actually move logistics by air. And the other one that springs to mind is Market Garden, which was...
And that's exactly what I was going to say. Market Garden, it's a little bit, obviously, the scale is considerably different, but the concepts, unfortunately, were very much at play. What can you do? For those who may not know, what were the gist of the Market Garden operation during World War II that's at play here, potentially?
Yeah, well, Market Garden was one of Montgomery's sort of ill-fated schemes. It was a great leap forward. But, of course, they landed, I think from memory, they landed, you may know this better than me, they landed very close to two resting German armored divisions from memory, something like that. And they were light troops. They did, you know, they fought very well. But eventually, the plan, which was to to follow up and be supported from a thrust north into the area that they landed. They landed to hold on to troops, didn't work, and so they were eventually defeated. And again, logistics is the issue.
The movie A Bridge Too Far, if anybody wants to Google
it
that.
Excellent
movie, by the way, but on its own accord, but the principles are still very painful to this day.
Yeah, and it's all about logistics. You know, this famous thing, I think it was Omar Bradley, said, you know, amateurs do tactics and professionals do logistics. And it's all about logistics and getting those logistics across. And there's only so much you can do by air. So, this is the way I'd be thinking about it. So you would need to at some stage early on in that air assault, if you manage to secure an island or somewhere on the north, then you can start to get your logistics across and do it by sea almost certainly. So the complications are almost endless, and the potential for any landing place that you've actually secured to be bombarded using hypersonic missiles, ballistic missiles and drones is... just gives you a level of difficulty, which is something that I just don't think we're used to. The best people to plan this, I'm sure, would be the Russians. Because, again, you're in the same sort of situation where we've seen in the Russia-Ukraine war the change in the way that military operations are done. And so the problems about massing forces, even in UAE, for example, I'm almost certain that in UAE there would be very good intelligence for the Iranians, and they're just far into the assembly points, Danny. So, it's an operation which just looks fraught with an avalanche of cascading difficulties and with lots of casualties. I mean, another good example is Iwo Jima, and people say, oh, yeah, I think I might have heard Lindsey Graham. Yeah. Well, what Lindsey Graham didn't talk about was the level of casualties in Iwo Jima, which is 26,000 overall, roughly speaking, of which 19,000 were wounded and the remainder were killed in action. And is the United States ready to take casualty numbers running into the thousands in an operation like this? And I suspect that that's something that even those who might be sort of gung-ho about this, even the Jack Keens of this world, might want to think twice about.
And let me ask you something on that point here. And then in the last few minutes that we have, can you talk about what your assessment and your analysis is about what would be the consequences if we go ahead and give the order here, and President Trump, and that headline that Gary was showing a minute ago from this from these conversations he had at the cabinet meeting, he said they better hurry because time is running out. I can't remember the exact phrase, but he said this is like their last chance, something like that. So if he does go ahead and give this order and there is an attempt here and military fundamentals and math work the way they always have and all these other examples we're talking about and logistic problems, et cetera, and we do suffer a lot of casualties and maybe we don't even succeed at getting the island itself. We had Joe Kent on earlier today, who is an 11-time combat vet himself. He used to work for the CIA and, of course, just resigned from the Office of Defense, the Tulsi's group there. He said, if I were in my enemy's shoes, he said, I would let the U.S. troops land and then subject them to all this stuff so that they have to just try to keep reinforcing. I can just keep picking them off, whether they do or whether they get hit on the way in. What is your assessment of the ramifications in the global viewpoint? If we fail the way if math holds and that we don't succeed here, we do take casualties, what is that going to do to our credibility and reputation? You mentioned ago markets, they go up and down a lot on impressions, and then other people around the world imagine what's going to happen. What do you think would happen if we don't succeed in this and do suffer casualties?
I think it would be more catastrophic than already is. It's not great at the moment, is it? You know, the situation at the moment is that the rest of the world, not the West, of course, because we're all propagandized, but the rest of the world are actually seeing what appears to be a strategic miscalculation leading to a strategic defeat. And I think what this would do is just reinforce that. I think one of the things as well it would do is it would bring to an end the idea that actually the West in general, but the United States in particular, are all powerful, because it would show that a much smaller in terms of its military expenditure country has managed to defeat the United States. And it would tell a lie to the idea that our our troops, whether they be Western troops generally or American troops in particular, are the greatest in the world. I mean, it seems to me to show the, sorry, I've got two ducks walking past my, two amphibians walking past my door. It would show that,
touché.
Yeah, that it would show, I think, that these great amphibious, these great military forces are no longer as omnipotent as we.
And
we
to your point there, Gary, showing this breaking news right here, Iran apparently is mobilizing 1 million fighters, and we've known that they've had that in their capabilities. And you can say, oh, well, they're not very good, they're not poor, but hey, a million of anything on top of their regular active forces, which is around a half a million. That's going to be a pretty tall order to have to do something with on the ground with a few thousand Americans.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you don't have to be a military genius to work out that, you know, two Mews of about, as you say, there are two reinforced battalions in there of about 600 to 700 each. And let's say the first, you know, the ready brigade of the 82nd Airborne, and let me guess, that three reinforced battalions at about 2,000 each. So to me, it doesn't sound like, what's that? That's 3,000, 4,000. It doesn't sound to me like 4,200 versus a million or whatever troops is going to work very well, whatever the. And, especially
and obviously they're not going to mass all their troops in one location, but that tells you they've got enough. You can overmatch anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, well, you might be able to overmatch locally, and you'd have to do it using air power, because you'd need to actually get to the stage where the air power was actually providing you, making it very, very difficult for any responding troops. I mean, this is what the Allies did during the Normandy landings, and they did make it extremely difficult for the Germans to respond. Yeah. But I just don't. What the Germans didn't have. Is they didn't have drones, and they didn't have ballistic missiles, and they didn't have hypersonic missiles. I mean, they knew where the Allies' landing were eventually, even though we did have the advantage of surprise. But because they didn't have those opportunities, imagine what it would be like if Normandy, and it wasn't easy Normandy, especially for those on Omaha, but imagine if the Germans had tunable V1 and V2 rockets that they could just fire indiscriminately onto the landing zones. It would have been catastrophic, or the air zone. So to me, this is a if it's tried, it will almost certainly be a bloodbath. I mean, it's sort of the rings of the charge of the Light Brigade, you know, and it's going into an absolute furnace. And I just hope that cooler heads and cooler military heads prevail, because I suspect that the Pentagon take exactly the same view. I'd be surprised if not. They must know what the risks involved in this. So I think the timing issue is about Luke Groman and I have been talking about, which is if the Straits are closed for another 2 to 4 weeks, then the global consequences are catastrophic. And I will send you the link to Luke's
and that mirrors, by the way, what Jeff Currie said, literally the same thing. The physical market is going to hit bite sometime in the next couple of weeks. I mean, so there's more and more experts making that same kind of concerning, problematic prediction.
Let me give you an example. If you take the things that are exported from through the Straits, one of them is LNG. Another, it happens, is helium. Now, where does some of that go? Both of those go to Taiwan. Why is that important for Taiwan? It's important for two reasons. Firstly, Taiwan has about, we think, 9 days' worth of LNG left. It uses LNG to actually power its factories and its electricity grid. It also produces 90% of the world's semiconductors. So all of a sudden, you know, you're talking about Taiwan stopping, and it's interesting that the Chinese have offered to support them, and I hope they do. But if that indeed plays out as we think it could do, and suddenly the Taiwanese electrical grid comes into trouble, and so no longer have we got the 90% of the world's semiconductors available, then whole loads of industries that rely on semiconductors are suddenly going to be in trouble.
And even if we're talking about ramifications, even as you're talking, I had not heard that. That's news to me. But that's just got to start adding up to a lot of people. Europeans, our allies in the Middle East, and now even our friends in Asia are starting to say, it's not really good to be a friend of America when they're taking these kind of rash actions, and people are going to have to start recalibrating. Do we need to change any of our associations? I mean, tell me that's not going to happen.
I'd be astonished if it doesn't happen. I think the way to think about the world economy is, you know, our world economy is a consequence of a lot of it is the sort of capital models that we have, the capitalistic model. But what it means is it's extremely efficient as long as there's energy and as long as everything's flowing right, because the just enough, just in time processes means that it's a very, very efficient, but there's very little resilience in it. So as soon as you start to break things, then suddenly things like the things that we assume, which is that, you know, if we order something from China, it will come. Suddenly those things start to break down as the bunker fuel that's available to actually run the ships breaks down, as the diesel that's available.
Right,
so
right.
All of the thing is extremely fragile. And I have said for many years now that globalization, which people see as a sort of force of nature, is actually simply a function of cheap energy. It's really relatively
cheap energy, and it works as long as you don't have people being stupid and starting wars they shouldn't start. Yeah. Everyone can benefit. No one, and then everyone's going to lose if somebody gets stupid. And now here we have it on parks. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to leave it for there right now. I've got to actually show up on a different channel somewhere here. But this has been absolutely fascinating, incredibly illuminating. Thank you so much for showing us really the ground or the water truth for what's going to happen here in the Gulf if we try to do something even more foolish than we have so far. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, pleasure. Keep up the good work, Daddy. Talk soon.
All of our pleasure. Thank you very much, and appreciate you guys too. We'll look forward to seeing you on the very next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. Don't forget to tell your friends, the ones that love to listen to podcasts. Get them to add Daniel Davis Deep Dive to their podcast list. They need to know what you know. They can get it to where they already get their podcast. You just got to tell them.